Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by our friends at the Expert Institute. Expert Institute is a company that assists trial lawyers in finding the right experts for your case and in helping you prepare your case for settlement or for trial. The way they do that is in a number of services that they offer. One is that if you need an expert in a case, a specific expert from a particular specialty or geographic location, they will go out and perform a search for that expert and a unique search for every case for each expert. So you're not using the same tired old experts who testify in case after case. They're actually going out and finding new people to serve as experts in your case. They've found me some really great experts in areas that are often really hard for me to find on my own, places where I've struck out in the past and found experts that didn't perform well, areas such as orthopedic surgery, neurointensive care. I even had them find me an expert in a case involving security at a convenience store. So they can locate experts in all different types of cases, whether it's personal injury, product liability, medical malpractice. The other great part about Expert Institute is if you're looking for an expert in a case, they'll often give you several options so that you can meet and interview multiple possible experts and choose the best one. So you're not just backed into using the whatever expert is most convenient or just happens to be available. It's actually a robust process where you're finding the best person for the job. And that adds significant value in cases. So if you're interested in working with Expert Institute, I would encourage you to give them a call or check them out online. If you search for them at expertinstitute.com/elevate, you can get a 25% off discount on your first expert consultation. Our show today is also brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is a case management system. I wanted to say software, but it's really more than software these days because they offer a full cloud-based integration, so you don't really need software. It's all available for you. Everything is stored and processed through the cloud. They have a server-based application as well, but it seems like more and more folks are moving more toward cloud-based programs, which is the way we use it. It's a fantastic program to the point where I was meeting with one of my paralegals the other day, and she exclaimed, "Ben, the best decision you made since opening this new law firm was getting Smart Advocate. It's awesome." And it's really great to hear that from my staff and the people who have to do the really hard work of managing a volume of cases, intakes, and discovery all the way up through trial. So we've had a great result with Trial Advocate. It's a very powerful and robust program. I know it's used by firms that do multi-district litigation and class action and literally have tens of thousands of clients all the way down to smaller PI firms. It can be customized for each particular application. In our case, where we do a lot of medical malpractice cases and have very record and document intensive cases, it's also worked well for that. We can text and email our clients right through the interface. It automatically saves all of that correspondence so we can see what's happening, and it's really worked well for us. So I encourage you to contact Smart Advocate if you're looking for case management software and check it out. Our show today is also sponsored by our friends at Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a full-service digital marketing firm for trial lawyers. Micah and Tyler at Hype Legal had worked at High Impact, which is a trial animation and graphics firm, for a collective 20-plus years. So they're very familiar with trial lawyers and what we do. And now they're taking the skill set that they developed there in high-end graphics and aesthetics and putting that to use for legal marketing. If you go to their website at hypelegal.com, you can check out a number of law firm websites and digital marketing campaigns that they've created, including the graphics and the website for our podcast, which is really terrific. So I encourage you to check out hypelegal.com.
This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Ben Gideon.
And I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
Rahul, what's new in your world? I understand you were about to start a trial yesterday, and now you're off a couple weeks. What's going on with you?
Yeah, the LA Superior Court system down here, social distancing restrictions have been lifted, so a lot of the courtrooms are starting to open up, and I'm starting to slowly see the wheels of justice start to turn, which is good, but not good enough. We didn't get sent out to trial, and we got kicked a couple of weeks, and hopefully it'll happen soon enough. How's everything over there?
You know, it's things move slower here in the Northeast. We're about to hear from Josh Koskoff from Connecticut, but in Maine, they have not held a civil jury trial for since the pandemic began, and from what I can tell, we won't have any in 2021, despite pushing quite hard for it. So it's really frustrating, to be honest. So why don't we move to our guest today? We're really pleased to invite
Josh Koskoff to our podcast.
Josh is a trial lawyer from Connecticut. Josh has had a terrific career. He's had a number of record-setting verdicts, particularly in the area of medical malpractice. He runs a large and very successful firm in Connecticut, and one of the things that we'll talk about today, but that I really admire about Josh and his firm, is their willingness to take on righteous cases that for really important causes. One of those is a case he's been litigating now against the Remington Firearms Company. I wanted to invite him on to talk a little bit about that. But before we do and get into that, Josh, welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Raul. It's a pleasure to be with you guys virtually. Probably enjoying this more than actually when we're physically together, to be honest.
Well, I mean, you know, there's less drinking involved when we're virtual.
That's true.
I don't know if that's true, but that's fine.
So Josh, what's going on in Connecticut? Are you guys actually seeing any civil jury trials these days?
We... as far as I know, I think we're like you. I don't believe we've had a bona fide civil trial in front of a jury yet, as far as I know, other than we've had some courtside cases. One of my partners, a wonderful partner, Kathleen Nastri, tried a case in front of a federal court judge and got a terrific verdict. But of course, that wasn't in front of a jury. So, I'm probably like you guys, trying to figure out how to climb out of this mountain of backlog that, you know, we're facing.
But before we get into some of the cases we want to talk about, you're a third generation Koskoff, now the named Koskoff at the Koskoff and Biter firm in Connecticut. And I actually met your dad once, but only very briefly, but he was really a great and an impressive trial lawyer from what I know. But what was it like growing up with that kind of legacy, and how did you find your own voice as a trial lawyer with such, you know, prominent dad and grandfather trial lawyers?
Well, it didn't come naturally or easy for me in terms of being a lawyer and finding my own way, because although I had many advantages because of the work that my grandfather had done and my dad continued at the firm, so I got to stand on their shoulders, Ben, but in terms of finding my way and feeling my legs from, you know, under me, it really took me quite a long time to develop my own style. Growing up was fun. My grandfather, I was the firstborn grandson in many traditions, but certainly the Jewish tradition. It was an embarrassment of riches being the first grandson. It was like none of the other grandkids really mattered. And my grandfather used to have this expression, in Yiddish expression for me. He used to call me talk shit, which means big shot. And, you know, so I had a special relationship with my grandfather, who I didn't work with as a lawyer, but I did work driving him around in his 46-foot Lincoln Continental. And that was a harrowing experience because he couldn't go slow enough on the highway. And you know, he would say, "Where's the fire?" when I try to gun it up to 55 miles an hour. But I got to hear great stories, you know, trial lawyer stories. And as you guys know, the practicing as a trial lawyer there's a lot of risk. There's a lot of stress. There's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of dysfunction. But there's also a lot of great stories. And so I heard amazing stories about my grandfather's clients. The client he got off for setting fire to his own factory, but also whose case he lost when the same guy tried to collect insurance for that fire. And, you know, the characters. And my dad was somewhat of a hippie and did a lot of work early on, especially with the Black Panthers. And so we had Panthers in the Panthers. We had members of the Black Panthers in our home. And they were great characters and great friends, really. And I got to know them because I was the age difference wasn't that significant. And so there was the guy that we represented who was a mafia guy who got rubbed out one day. Uncle Frank, we called him. You know, he'd bring bagels to the house, and we all loved him as kids. And then one day we said, "Where's Uncle Frank?" It's Sunday, and my dad broke the news that he'd been basically rubbed out like a gangster that I guess he was. You know, we had people escape from our house who were on furlough. And we had, occasionally my dad would share stories about some of the tragic cases he represented in terms of civil lawsuits. So it was a very vibrant upbringing. And I thought all lawyers did what the three of us do. I thought they just all went to court and tried cases and represented deserving people. I didn't realize what a minority we actually were. And so that's why if I wanted to become a lawyer at all as a kid, it was that kind of law that I'm now ending up doing. So it was really a great experience and probably somewhat in my blood because of those stories.
Now, I'm just curious. So with your grandfather and your dad and their styles and personas, what was it about theirs or did anything about them make it harder for you to sort of unlearn some of the things you may have emulated from them? And then how did you develop your own style?
Yeah. It's a great question because unlearning is something that you don't think of consciously, but you probably, it probably is what's happening for most of the time in your early development as a lawyer. Whether you have a family lineage as lawyers or not, you're really unlearning a lot. And you're also learning a lot, of course, but I was just describing this to some lawyer, and I don't mean to punt the question, but I have these two young high school kid and a college kid working here for the summer, and I was just explaining to them how long it takes to shed all of the stuff that you grow up with and all of the preconceptions about what lawyers should be until you are really reduced to yourself in court and feel comfortable being yourself. And it's not until you get there that you start to find that you're having success. I think I emulated my grandfather in a little bit who had a grand gesture, and I like to be Mr. Grand Gesture. I emulated my dad because he was dramatic and empathic and passionate. And both of those, certain aspects of both of those things fit me like a glove, and certain aspects just didn't feel right. And I can't explain it other than I feel that I had enough failure early on to succeed. Just enough failure to succeed. There's a way of looking at it. And that it got to the point early on where I was wondering whether this kind of work was for me. And I don't know about your first successes as lawyers where you actually felt like it was because something you did, but for me it just happened really by accident, and it was probably within about 6 months of me hanging them up and thinking I couldn't do this job. So I couldn't articulate exactly what it was I unlearned, but whatever it was allowed me to succeed in the courtroom.
What was that turning point for you when you first realized that this is something you could be really good at? And what would you say to you know, newer lawyers that are starting out that are still in the phase where they're questioning or struggling?
Yeah. Well, what I would say is that perseverance is important in terms of getting back up on your feet. And that those humiliations that we all go through as young lawyers, everybody goes through them. So the people that, that Ben, you and me and Raul emulate, some people in our groups, Brian Panish is, you know, an example, what phenomenal lawyer. If you sat down with Brian and you talked to him about his early experiences, he would cop to having real struggles. And so for me, it was some realization of I have to keep plugging away to a reasonable extent until I know I can't do this. And, you know, my dad would say, look, you know, when I, Richard Beter, who's the partner and a third partner of Koskoff, Koskoff and Beter, I would come home and I'd say, well, I lost a case. And he said, no, that's not really. He goes, how long was the jury out? And I said, I don't know, about an hour. He goes, that's amazing. You kept them out an hour on that piece of crap, you know? Or he'd say, I'd say, I lost another case. He'd go, you can't even come close to my record. And he'd say, I lost my first nine cases. And I noticed that every time somebody would lose a case, he goes, well, that's not so bad. I lost my first 10 cases. Next time was I lost my first 11 cases. But what Richard was trying to do was he was trying to remind us that nobody just, it just doesn't happen because you're a magical person and you have this magic that nobody else does. It happens through, like Martin Luther King would say, continuous struggle. And so I think that helped get me far enough. And I've also said that a lot has to go wrong for you to have that first success. You know, it's the trial that, it's the case, I bet for you guys, it was the case that was going to settle that didn't, or that should have settled that didn't, or that you didn't want to try, but somehow you had to. And so that has led me to say, just a lot has to go wrong for you to have success in this business, because we will take off-ramps if we can too often, too early, to avoid the anxiety of losing a case or the risk. And so essentially the first case where the turnaround case for me was a malpractice case. And I had tried to convince the plaintiff to drop the case, but God bless her, she wouldn't let me. And it was a case, I'll just very briefly, where we settled with two parties. My partner Jim Horowitz, and they were the two. If there was a Papa Bear, a Mama Bear, a Baby Bear, they were Papa Bear and Mama Bear. And Baby Bear was a doctor who had seen the patient who ultimately died about a year before his death. So we got Jim, through his skill, got a bunch of money for Papa Bear and Mama Bear case. And I said to the widow, whose name was Vita Carlson, who I owe all of my professional accomplishments to her, because if she hadn't done this, I don't know where I'd be. But I had said to her, you know, Vita, you got this money. This case against this Dr. Goldsmith is a hard case. He saw your husband a year before, and, you know, he didn't die till a year later, and there was a surgery and all these things. And so, you know, I'm thinking, you got, you know, do you want to drop it? If we try it, there's more costs. And she said she would talk to her family, and she talked to her family, and she called me back, and she said, well, I will drop this case depending on how you answer this question. And she said, was Gary's EKG the year before normal? Now, the EKG was nonspecific. So the actual honest answer is no, because it wasn't normal. If she had said, was it abnormal, I probably would have said, I would have had to say no also, because it was nonspecific. So the way she phrased that question was critical. And I said, no. And she said, well, let's give it a shot. And we had offered to settle with them for $250,000. And they were pretty reasonably at some point saying no, that they weren't going to pay any money. And then during the trial, I think because I had all this anxiety about my future, and I was left to my own devices. Jim had bailed on me, thinking he wanted no part of this loser. And I had, like, the first day just went really well. Just went really well. I wasn't used to a day like that. And then the second day went really well. And then I started thinking about decisions that I could make, and my decisions started to pay off. And I started to see a real cause and effect. And by the end of that trial, I was convinced that we had a good shot. And I had sent a letter demanding the policy, which was $1 million. And they told me to pound sand. And the jury came in with a $10 million verdict. And then the case was reversed for a reason I don't need to get into. It was an evidentiary ruling, which I knew was going to be a problem on apportionment. But on retrial, they also said it was going to, that the first verdict was an aberration. And I was thinking, I'm going to win again. I'm going to, you know, do twice as well. I'm thinking, oh shit, here goes my one victory. And so, and the second, and you know what, I don't know if you've tried a case twice. It's very hard to get back up a second time. You know, you'd almost rather have a decision the first time around that sticks, even if it's a loss, you can move on. And the second time the jury came back with $22 million. And so I sent I couldn't help. This is the worst thing I've ever done. That the lawyer for the insurance company sent me an email saying that it was an aberration. So I printed out the email and I autographed it. And I sent him back a note that said, you're right, the first trial was an aberration. And that's when I learned. And then when I did that, I told my dad, he's like, all right, let this get to your head. You know,
what do you think explained the verdicts in those cases? And why did you and everybody else misjudge it? Because we like to think of ourselves as good judges of what makes a good case or a bad case.
You know, I think about court cases. I don't know if you think about it this way. It's like when football, they say, well, the game isn't played on paper. We can game out something in advance all we want. We can apply whatever things that make us feel that we know how to predict the future and how we can read cases and analyze cases and judge cases. And that's all on paper. You know, but it's not, but the courtroom is its own special place. And so it was just a case that looked a lot better without the other two defendants in it, first of all. And I think I appreciated reasonably early on that when you could focus just on one defendant instead of, because when he's in it with the other two, he's baby bear, right? But when he's not with the other two, he's just bear. And so I think that was one of the things. And, you know, the jury is being asked to decide this particular doctor's culpability in it, not in some sense the other two parties, but they were there in court to analyze him. And all of that gaming out, all of that prediction game, you kind of forget about it when you're on trial. And I know, and I still had gone through the age-old ritual, I guess, of thinking that I had won every case that I had lost until I lost it. And so it wasn't unusual for me to think that I'd won a case, really. It's just that this time I actually really think I knew I was going to win the case. And it was just because everything was breaking right.
So we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in about 60 seconds with more of Josh Koscoff.
During our quick break, I want to remind you that our show today is being sponsored by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is a case management program designed for trial law and personal injury law firms, all the way from smaller PI firms to the largest MDL and class action firms. It's the case management software we use at our office, and we love it. Our show also is sponsored by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a full-service digital marketing firm started by friends of the pod, Tyler and Micah, who have years of experience helping trial lawyers getting great results in their cases, and now they're turning that attention to digital marketing. So check them out at hypelegal.com. Our show today is sponsored by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the ultimate partner for helping trial lawyers pair with the right experts for their cases and working their cases up all the way from intake through verdict. So check them out at expertinstitute.com/elevate. ELAWVATE, and you will receive a 25% off discount on your first expert consult.
All right, so we're back with more of Josh Koscoff. Josh, I wanted to turn now to a case you're working on involving representing the victims of the Sandy Hook school shooting against the maker of the firearm, the AR-15 that was used to commit that shooting. Can you tell us a little bit about the case and what inspired you to get involved in it and how things are going right now?
I'd be happy to. What inspired me to get involved in the case was when I met with the first parent who asked me to look at the case. And, you know, it's like that scene in whatever, Jerry Maguire, you had me at hello. Like, I had probably been, I was certainly vulnerable, I guess. I'm not sure that's the right word, but I you know, this having happened in our backyard here, my office is 20 minutes from Newtown, and I had kids slightly older than the kids in the school, but could really relate as a parent, as so many of us could. And my instinct before I was even contacted was, what can we do to help these people? Like, that feeling of just, you know that feeling like you just, you want to use your privileges as a lawyer to reach out to the community and in when something catastrophic like this happened. So initially I was hoping that I could just help them maybe with probate stuff, even though I'm not a probate lawyer. Maybe I could put together a group of probate lawyers to do some pro bono things. Maybe they needed help with the press or the crunch. Early on, they needed help because so much money was raised by organizations, charities, and the United Way didn't know what to do with the money because it was such an outpouring of support. But then it created this problem of who do you give it to and how is that determined? And so that became its own animal, so to speak. And there was a whole system put into place where they brought in Ken Feinberg, who is the legendary mediator for the or arbitrator for these rare situations. And so initially it was a lot of that. But basically, I know that Ben, if Mark Barden or Nicole Hockley or any of these parents had come into your office, there's no chance you would have turned them away. And Raul, same thing. And any lawyers that we worked with, anybody that we consider to be people who are in this business for the right reasons and not for the wrong reasons, would be honored and feel compelled to take this case. So there was no chance I wasn't taking the case. There might have been a chance that I wasn't going to be able to find a case. But there was no chance that I wasn't going to try with along with my colleagues. Unlike a lot of cases, there was a lot of, it seems improbable now, but there was actual pushback, a little bit of pushback even within the legal community, because there was a concern that we would be seen as capitalizing on a tragedy, and our worst enemies' caricatures of us. And it was very surprising to me to get that kind of friendly fire. I expected a lot of pushback from, obviously, gun groups and the NRA and things like that. And I didn't take that lightly. But I certainly wasn't expecting pushbacks from lawyer organizations because, again, I thought, we're supposed to take on big challenges and new challenges. And we're not supposed to be daunted to the point of submission when we stare at a mountain of a hurdle to get over. So that was surprising. I know that wasn't your question, but I guess I bring it up because, my grandfather and my dad, if there's one thing that really carried down, it's that the type of law we do is more of a service profession than it is anything else, that we serve people. We serve the interests of people. And that they had a mantra, which is essentially, if you do good things for people, then good things will come to you from a business standpoint, like a financial standpoint. And if they don't, you've still done good things for people. And that mantra didn't always serve this my law firm well. Like there were years where we were just struggling to keep the lights on, not knock on wood recently as much, but, we've been around for almost 80 years. And that investment in serving and good people and doing good things for people really makes participating in the Sandy Hook lawsuit a no-brainer.
Can you talk a little bit about how you envisioned the case and put it together? Because, anybody who's followed this for any period of time understands that although the cause is as compelling as you described it, that no one has really had much success suing manufacturers of firearms because there's a lot of law that makes it difficult or impossible for people to bring those cases, federal preemption, et cetera. So you found a way around that, at least so far. Can you explain how you envision that and what the case involves?
Yeah, well, one thing that was truly a gift was my own ignorance about these laws. You guys may have known about how difficult it was to sue a gun industry, but I didn't. And so that I came to it with very sort of open and pure and optimistic that we could find a way. And when I discovered and started to learn about the law, especially the federal, what you probably refer to as preemption, or it probably isn't classic preemption, but it's immunity of a sort. And that is a 2005 immunity that it doesn't say don't even think about suing a gun company, but it comes pretty close. I thought, well, when I saw that statute, I thought it was unconstitutional. I thought it had to be a joke. And I read all the cases, and turns out it's been deemed to be constitutional, and it's definitely deemed not to be a joke. But I thought, to me, that represented a challenge. So what we did was we looked very specifically at the language of the statute, and we tried to build a case through some of the statute's exceptions, some of which are exceptions in name only, some of which have a little bit of daylight in them, notably an exception to bring cases based on a violation of a state statute. And another exception is a claim for negligent entrustment. So you can bring a claim against a firearm seller for negligently entrusting a firearm. The negligent entrustment was my hook. That did not ultimately carry the day, but it was another theory you had that carried the day. But I really thought, again, my naivete about guns and just sort of this whole looking at this fresh, I said, isn't it clear that selling like a AR-15, which is an M16, in terms of the military, isn't it clear that by this time in 2012 that was a negligent entrustment to, because civilians have proven themselves incapable of using these things responsibly. So at this point, in my mind, when we filed this case, you know, selling a civilian AR-15 was a negligent entrustment. And although, you know, typically a negligent entrustment is you give keys to a drunk driver, it's a arm's length deal. This was more of a bigger picture, but I thought it was very much a winning argument. And, you know, one of the things that really did it for me was, since I also knew literally nothing about guns, what I learned about them, I could kind of react like a child would react to learning about something for the first time. So that reaction that a kid has is always so vibrant and honest, right? And it leads to instant creativity. Anybody's, you know, you got kids, you know, they're incredibly creative because they're instantly reacting to new things. And so one of the things that I was reacting to when learning about the AR-15 and really finding out about its history was that in the military, if you go into the military, you are not granted permission to hold an AR, or essentially maintain an AR-15 within your possession unless you've gone through 100 hours of training. They are then locked up on bases, and they are issued to you during the day for your drills, and then they are locked back up. And I had a secretary at the time here in the office, and he was just out of the military. And I asked him, I said, Andrew, you know, what do you know about these AR-15s or these M16s? And he said, well, I know one thing, that when I took a shower, I had to leave the curtain open because that weapon had to be in my sight at all times, or I could be court-martialed. And I said, okay, we got ourselves a case here. Because how can it be that a weapon designed for that theater and a weapon that was introduced into the structure of the military and only be issued to a soldier after 100 hours, how could an 18-year-old, or in some cases a 21-year-old, depending on where you are, waltz into a local Walmart and pick up an AR-15 with no training? And in the structureless world that we live in civilian life, and no mental health exam. That's the other thing you have in military. So I thought, isn't that a classic negligent entrustment? Taking a product that was designed to be used in one environment, and then taking that same product and selling it and introducing it to the stream of commerce of an environment it was never meant to be in, to be used and owned by people it was never be meant to be used and owned by. So here we are sort of molding that way of looking at it and trying to fit it into this exception of negligent entrustment. At the same time, one thing about the case is that we learned, along with others, because a lot was made about the marketing by Bushmaster of this particular AR-15. Bushmaster is it might be confusing to your listener, that actually Bushmaster was owned by Remington. And so that's what we call Remington is the parent sort of conglomerate at that time that owned Bushmaster, which was at that point a brand. Remington's also a brand, but when we talk about Remington, we're talking about a conglomerate. But anyway, the Bushmaster was advertised in such a way as to extol the military virtues, extol the lone gunman, extol the manliness or machismo of owning a weapon. And it all but said, you are a wimp if you don't own this weapon. And it all but said, you know, own this weapon and your enemies will regret ever having picked on you. And it's not even subtle. And so one of the parents of one of the six-year-olds who died in the shooting, Jackie Barden, her son Daniel died. Actually, he wasn't six. He was seven. He had just turned seven. And she was learning about this shortly after his death. And it broke her when she saw these advertisements saying, your man card has been reissued, seeing the weapon extolled that led to the death of Daniel. And so from the beginning, we knew there was something wrong with that marketing. And there's another exception to this immunity that allows for cases to be brought if state law is violated. The law has to be applicable to the sale or marketing of a firearm. And so what we said was that our state Unfair Trade Practices Act, which proscribes immoral, unethical, and unscrupulous conduct in business, was a state statute, and that they violated it with this marketing. There were a host of sub-issues that were problems with, that were challenges with that, say. One was, can you recover for personal injury or wrongful death damages as a result of a violation of a unfair trade practice? Another was, did you have to be in a business relationship? In other words, the victims of the shooting were not in a business relationship with Remington. The shooter was, but the victims weren't. And some states, that would be a deal breaker right there, because some states in their statute explicitly limit the standing to those who are in a business relationship. Our statute was silent on that, but our statute had been interpreted to me in a manner so that you had to establish a business relationship to have standing to bring a suit. The Supreme Court of Connecticut, we pointed out a lot of flaws in the logic of that particular case, which was an appellate court Connecticut case. The Supreme Court reversed that case and cleared the way and said we did have standing to sue. They found we met the statute of limitations. They found that you could claim wrongful death damage. They found all the other ancillary issues in our favor as well, and allowed us to proceed on what they called was a narrow theory of their violation of CUTPA in the way that they marketed the use of these weapons for criminal purposes. At the same time, the state killed the negligent entrustment, my brilliant idea. They thought it was too much like products liability, in essence, too much strict liability to say, you know, just selling a weapon, even a weapon like this, to civilians is negligence. They weren't willing to take that big a bite. Sadly, I think that, you know, as time goes on, it's proving more and more true that we as a society just don't know how to use these weapons, store them, prevent them from being used in to commit mass murder. And even if it's, you know, one in a million, it's not, you know, the risk isn't worth it. But the bottom line is that we now very much have a live contest on our hands. And we've gone through many, many hurdles after the Supreme Court of Connecticut reversed and gave us back our at least part of our case. Remington petitioned for certification for the United States Supreme Court. And this being a high profile, quote unquote, case involving firearms, you know, we were, you know, it had more than your typical chance, maybe, of getting, of them granting cert. You know, as you guys know, they grant a very, maybe 1% or fewer petitions for cert because it's only one court and they get thousands of petitions. But I think people thought that they had a fighting chance, and fortunately we were able to beat that down as well. But that then they declared not one, but two bankruptcies. So we've been in and out of bankruptcy court. We've been up and down to the state Supreme Court. We've had to fight off a challenge to the United States Supreme Court. And now we're back in Connecticut. And in fact, yesterday I filed my second motion to objection to their motion to strike. Tomorrow we're filing a motion to compel some of emails. Funny, you would think that you know, in 5 years they would have generated more than about the 50 emails that they've sent us so far. And I suspect there are probably, you know, 500,000 emails that we haven't seen yet.
Well, like I said earlier, this is a righteous cause and we're all behind you. If any of us out here can do anything to help, please reach out. But we're all pulling for you, and I hope you get a great result in that case. And there is a kind of related matter, isn't there, that involves the news InfoWars host Alex Jones, who was promoting conspiracy theories about the Sandy Hook shooting and the victims. Mm-hmm. You're involved in some litigation relating to him as well.
Yeah, actually, right now there's three people in my office. One is me, another is my partner Chris Maddie, and another is one of our clients in that case, who's being deposed right now by Alex Jones' lawyers.
Well, Josh, they always say that doing the right thing is not always doing the easy thing. And you're definitely pursuing some righteous stuff. And we are absolutely all following you. So thanks for all your hard work. And thanks for continuing to be an inspiration to all of us. Speaking of inspirations, for the younger lawyers out there, for the new lawyers, for those who are wanting to become a trial lawyer, any advice, any wisdom that you can share with them to be the best that they can be?
I think that if you want to be a lawyer, I think that you'll be happier if you ask yourself whether you are working with human beings or whether you are working not with human beings. Like if you're representing a person, then you're doing something I think that you'll find very rewarding. That's what I tell a lot of young lawyers, that because, you know, they come out of law school and there's so many different jobs for lawyers and so many different types of law. And I just, I feel strongly that if you ask yourself, is the type of law I'm doing the type of law where at the end of my experience working for this person that they're going to give me a hug? And if the answer is yes, then you're in a good situation, and you'll find much reward in that. Because there's no greater reward than working with people, especially deserving people.
I'm the only one here who does not come from a lineage of lawyers, but I now really wish I did, because both of you guys are really amazing trial lawyers, and getting to learn from day one probably couldn't be perceived as anything other than a value add, and really learning from good people so that you could turn out to be what you've become, Josh. And what you've become, Ben. So this is fun. I don't know if this is side talk yet, but I just want to say that I've been really, really enjoying doing the Elevate podcast with Ben, because we get to meet and sit down with amazing lawyers like yourself, Josh. And every single time we end a podcast, I sit there and I have a list of notes of all of the things that I need to do better in my own life. And it's made me a better person and a better lawyer already. So thanks for that. Thank you, Ben.
Yeah. And thank you, Raul. I mean, we could say the same for you. You truly are an inspiring lawyer, and you've had incredible results. I don't think you need to grow up with a law professor or a lawyer father to have success in this business. But thanks for your kind words. And Josh, thank you very much for coming on the show today and sharing your description about your career and your amazing case against Remington. We're going to be looking forward to reading about the results in that case in the coming months. So good luck with that. To our listeners, thank you for tuning in. We'll see you all for our next episode in 2 weeks.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.